From the home of the codebreakers and the birthplace of modern computing, this is the Bletchley Park podcast.
Welcome to another Bletchley Park podcast extra. In this episode, we bring you another one of the talks from the Codebreaker Legacy event that was held at Bletchley Park. Professor Jack Copeland talks about one of his greatest heroes, Tommy Flowers. From his early life and career, leading up to working with the Bletchley Park Codebreakers, which would ultimately lead to what many would call Tommy's greatest achievement, the invention of Colossus, the world's first programmable electronic digital computer. What I especially like about this talk is the really simple and engaging way that Jack explains both how the Lorentz, or Tunny as it was known by the Codebreakers, worked, and how Codebreakers such as Bill Tutt, Alan Turing and Max Neumann, with the help of engineers such as Tommy, finally broke into Hitler's most secret code. If you'd like to attend a similar event, for example our current Bletchley Park Presents season of talks, then please go to www.bletchleypark.org.uk and look in the What's On section. Or just listen out for our regular updates in the monthly podcast.
Tommy Flowers is one of my greatest heroes, so it's an absolute pleasure to be talking about him here today. Flowers's most significant contribution, of course, was to design and build the world's first large-scale electronic computer, Colossus. And here is the man himself. This photograph of Flowers was given to me by Flowers' son, Kenneth. And when he handed it to me, it was in the form of an old-fashioned black-and-white print. And it had obviously been screwed up into a ball at some point in its existence, presumably by a young child, though I don't know. You can imagine a child kind of crumpling it up and throwing it into the waste paper bin. Bad grandfather. But anyway, great flakes of emulsion were peeling off this photograph, and quite significant portions of Flowers were conspicuously absent. But we restored it. And of the small number of photographs of Flowers that exist, this is my favourite. You get the super intelligent gaze, you get the boyish good looks, you get a kind of feeling for Flowers' physical slightness. He wasn't a short man, but there was something slightly insubstantial about his appearance. And of course, you also get the ever-present brilliantine job on the hair, his trademark. Let me begin at the beginning. Flowers was born in 1905 in East London, in the district of Poplar, in a rented room, in fact. And he was born just a stone's throw from the area where his father was born. His father was also called Tom. And his father was born in Whitechapel within the sound of Bow Bells, which is, of course, the traditional criterion for Cockneyhood. And so Flowers Jr. also grew up in a Cockney-speaking world. And Flowers told me that he could remember when he was young children walking barefoot in the streets. And he said that his own family lived barely above subsistence level, although things improved later, but that's how Flowers spent the first part of his youth. His interest in engineering emerged at quite an early age, and when he was told at the age of 9 that he was going to acquire a new baby sister, Flowers said very earnestly that he would much rather have a new Meccano set. In his mid-teens, he served an apprenticeship at Woolwich Arsenal in the Docklands of East London. Woolwich Arsenal was, at that time, justly famous for the precision mechanical engineering that was carried on there. So it was a very good place for an up-and-coming engineer to carry out an apprenticeship. Once his apprenticeship was over in 1926, he joined the telephone branch of the post office. He taught himself electrical engineering, and along the way, he picked up a degree in engineering, a night school degree, from the Elephant and Castle Poly, which is now, of course, South Bank University. And in 1930, Flowers sort of moved sideways and upwards a bit into the research branch of the telephone section of the post office. And then in 1933, this imposing building was erected in Dollis Hill in North London to serve as the headquarters of the telephone engineering research branch. This building is still there to be visited. And you can see that engraved in stone over the main entrance is their slogan that research is the door to tomorrow. It's kind of a naff slogan in many ways, I think, in, you know, kind of today's terms. But it gives you an idea of the optimism with which they were working and with which they constructed their new headquarters. Research, that's the thing. It will lead us into tomorrow. And it was in this building that Flowers constructed Colossus. Flowers, once he'd established himself at Dollis Hill, he rose rapidly. He got a series of quite meteoric promotions. And by 1939, he was head of the switching group at Dollis Hill. The type of switches that are best known from that era are relays, as they're called, electromechanical switches, partly electrical, partly consist of moving mechanical parts. So the relay was a switch that contained essentially a contact and a moving metal rod, and the metal rod could move away or make contact, and so that was the switch. It would make and break the circuit. And the moving rod had an electromagnet wound round it, so it was that electromagnet that controlled whether the rod would move away or whether it would move in and make contact. So that was the relay. Relays are still used today. They were kind of cutting-edge technology in the early 1930s, sort of the, in many ways the best they'd got, and they appeared everywhere. Flowers was an expert with relays, but really he didn't like them. He wanted to improve on the relay. His dream was to replace relay-based equipment in telephone exchanges with electronic valves. I mean, just from my description, the disadvantages of relays must be fairly obvious. They were large, they were clunky, they were slow. It took quite a while for that rod to move backwards and forwards. They thought of them as pretty fast in those days, but in today's terms, relays are just incredibly slow. They're even big enough for moths to get stuck inside between the moving rod and the contact. And that, of course, is the origin of the, I suspect most of you know this, the origin of the term bug. There's a bug in the machine, there's a bug in a program. It's because a moth got stuck in one of the American relay-based computers at Harvard. So Flowers was eager to do better. He knew about the use of electronic valves as high-speed switches. And at Dollis Hill, he was pioneering the use of electronic valves to make and break the connections between telephone exchanges. So Flowers was attempting to build quite large installations of valves at Dollis Hill. And in doing this, he was swimming against the prevailing tide, because what experts in the area believed was that you could never use valves reliably in large numbers. Valves were inherently unstable and unreliable, people thought. And that was because they contained a hot glowing filament, a red-hot filament, that was a source of an electron beam. That was why valves were so fast, because their only moving part was this beam of electrons. So they could do what they did very rapidly. But there was this inherent fragility built in. The red-hot element, as you can imagine, could easily break. Valves were prone to sudden death. And so if you used a small number, you'd be okay. 6, 12, 18 in a radio receiver or something like that. That would be reliable enough. But the more valves you used, the greater the chance that one of them would die, and so the whole installation would go down. So the idea was that if you tried to use, you know, hundreds of valves together, you'd get a machine that was out of action probably more than it was in action. Valves would always be blowing, the engineers would always have to be tracking down the culprit, replacing it with a new one, and so it just wouldn't be practicable to use large numbers of valves. Flowers had discovered that actually the reverse was true. If valves were properly used, they were much more reliable than relays. And what he managed to figure out was that it was the switching valves on and off, as typically happens with a radio receiver and so on, you're always turning it on, turning it off. It was that switching on and off that stressed the filaments of the valves. And so as long as you turn the equipment on and just left it on, valves were even more reliable than relays. So that was his great discovery. And during the 1930s at Dollis Hill, he was building installations containing as many as 3,000-4,000 valves, an unheard of number. He was building these installations in order to control the connections between telephone exchanges by means of audible tones, like today's touch tones. And Flowers's mammoth valve-based equipments actually went into service before the war in 1939. And also in 1938 to 1939, he was experimenting with digital electronics. The tones were not digital, that's more sort of in analog valve engineering. But Flowers knew that he could use electronic valves as high-speed switches, far faster and far more reliable than the relay. And so just before the war, he was experimenting with building a prototype high-speed digital data store using valves, again for use in telephone switchboards. Outside Flowers' small group at Dollis Hill, few people realised that valves could be used reliably in large numbers. Flowers was really breaking new ground here. And he told me that when war broke out in 1939, he was possibly the only person in Britain who understood that electronic valves could be used in large numbers to do high-speed electronic digital computing. So when Flowers was summoned here to Bletchley Park to help the Codebreakers, he turned out to be the right man in the right place at the right time. Flowers spent the first months of the war, not here, but working at Fighter Command, installing communication systems during the Battle of Britain. But not long after that, he was summoned to Bletchley Park to assist Turing in Turing's work against Enigma. Flowers and Turing hit it off almost immediately. There was a rapport between them. Flowers said that he felt that he was one of the few people who could understand Turing's explanations. Turing had this, you know, kind of image of being totally incomprehensible when he tried to explain anything. But Flowers said, no, he could understand straight away what Turing was talking about, and Turing could understand what he was talking about. They spoke each other's language. So there was this rapport from the beginning. And Flowers was commissioned to build a decoding machine for Enigma. It would see its action after the bomb had delivered settings for the Enigma message that they were trying to break. So the bomb would say, here's my best guess at the starting positions of the wheels of the Enigma machine for this message, and here's my best guess at how the Enigma machine plug board was connected up for this message. And then those settings would be copied over onto the machine that Flowers was to build. If things went well, his machine would decode stretches of the Enigma message that they were attacking. If the bomb's guess at the settings of the Enigma machine was wrong, then just garbage would come out of Flowers' machine. But if the bomb had made a correct guess at the settings, then the German ciphertext would be fed into Flowers' machine, and the German plain text, or sections of the German plain text, would come out of his machine. Basically, his machine was constructed entirely out of relays, and it was really a relay-based simulation of the Enigma machine. That was the idea. But somehow there was a miscommunication between Bletchley Park and Flowers. Bletchley Park's idea was that these decoding machines should be small enough so that they could be placed amongst the bombs. But somehow this information never got passed on to Flowers. And so he built quite a large relay-based machine, which was useless for the purposes that Bletchley Park required. So although Flowers' machine worked well enough, the form that he built never really saw active service. Nevertheless, Flowers was awarded the MBE for his work on Enigma, probably with a helping hand from Turing. And then with another helping hand from Turing, in 1942, Flowers was introduced to the leading problem at Bletchley Park. Enigma was pretty much cracked. They'd got in, they'd got the bombs, they just had to stay in, break the messages, do the work. Tunny was an entirely new cipher machine that just appeared. Bletchley Park knew absolutely nothing about it, and the problem was to break it. Tunny was, in some sense, the high-tech successor to Enigma. Enigma had a number of failings. Enigma was, in fact, yesterday's technology by the time the Second World War broke out. Enigma was designed during the 1920s. It was marketed commercially during the early 1930s. The German military took it over in the mid-1930s and added some additional bells and whistles to improve the security. But it was thoroughly outdated technology by the time war broke out. It was very slow to use. It was very clumsy to use. It required no fewer than six operators to encipher and transmit and then receive and decipher a single message. Six operators for one message. There was the cipher clerk who typed the German plain text at the keyboard of the Enigma at the sending end of the link. And then there was his assistant who would note down the letters of ciphertext as they lit up at the Enigma's lamp board, as they called it. And once all the letters of the ciphertext had been noted down, then that guy would pass the ciphertext on to the third player, the radio operator, who would then translate the entire business into Morse code and transmit it to the receiving end of the link. And there they'd do the entire process in reverse. So you can see there was considerable room for improvement. Not only was Enigma, you know, kind of personnel hungry, it required so many operators. Also, there was practically quite a severe limit on the length of messages that you could send. You know, as you can tell from the description I've given of it, it would be good for kind of half a page or a page. But if you wanted to send a long report, well, you could do it, but it really wasn't the most practicable proposition. So improvement was required, and when improvement came along, it was in the form of this machine, which the British codenamed Tunny. It was known to the Germans as the SZ-40. It was built by the Lorenz Company in Berlin. It was a wheeled machine like Enigma. I guess the wheel count for a machine is a rough indication of the complexity of the machine. So Enigma, the standard model, had three wheels. Later models had four wheels. The Tunny machine has 12 wheels. So obviously it's a considerably more complicated machine. It required only one operator at each end of the link. The Lorenz Company had managed to automate practically everything about the encryption and decryption process. So all those bods that were needed to encrypt and decrypt an Enigma message just weren't required for Tunny. It was all automatic. As far as the operators were concerned at each end of the link, it was German in, German out. The sending operator typed the plain German text at the keyboard of the teleprinter that was connected to the Tunny machine, and then at the other end of the link, plain German came out of the receiver's machine. The first Tunny link was at the beginning of 1941 between Berlin and Greece. These Tunny links didn't use Morse code the way that Enigma did. The output of the Tunny machine was based on teleprinter technology. And what it did was encrypted teleprinter code, and that encrypted teleprinter code, essentially just binary code, was broadcast straight to air. And so the British intercept operators, who were continually listening to all the German frequencies, they reported hearing a strange new music on the airwaves, and that was the sound of encrypted teleprinter code being transmitted at high speed. They used two tones to transmit it. And that was why you got the kind of musical burbling sound associated with Tunny. Enigma was just one tone, it was Morse code. The upside of using two tones is much faster, you've got two channels. The downside is that you've got more bandwidth, because you've got two channels, you've got more bandwidth. So you're more open to interference than you would be with Morse. With Morse, you've got just one channel, so that's minimum bandwidth. You're as safe as it's possible to be from interference. But with Tunny, you've got these two channels, you lay yourself open to interference, but nevertheless, you've got this much greater speed. And it all worked tremendously successfully. The experimental Tunny link from Berlin to Greece was a great success. And towards the end of 1942, the Tunny network started propagating across the whole of Europe to North Africa and out into Russia to the Eastern Front. It was kind of a harbinger of today's mobile phone networks. And here at Bletchley Park, they gave each new Tunny link, as it appeared, a fishy name. There's Bream from Berlin to Rome. There's Herring from Rome to Tunis. There's Jellyfish from Berlin to Paris, and so on. There were two large fixed exchanges for the Tunny messages, one in Berlin and one in Königsberg. Berlin tended to handle the Western links, and Königsberg handled the Eastern links out to the Russian front. And there were large fixed exchanges in some other important centres, for example, Paris. But At the distant ends of the tunny links, the tunny unit would be mobile. A mobile tunny unit consisted of two trucks, and those trucks would move with the frontline generals. They'd move with the fighting. One truck contained the radio equipment, and the other truck contained two tunny machines, one for sending and one for receiving, and it also contained the associated teleprinter equipment. In some ways, tunny is, I think, simpler to understand than Enigma. As with Enigma, the wheels were the guts of the tunny machine. It was the wheels that did the encryption. And as I said, there were 12 of them. And those 12 wheels broke into three separate groups. There were five Chi wheels, as they called them. For want of better terminology, Bletchley Park just used Greek letters to name components of the machine. So there were five Chi wheels, and there was another group of five Psi wheels. And then the remaining two wheels in the middle were the motor wheels, as they called them. The function of the motor wheels was slightly dull. The motor wheels just caused other wheels to turn, so we can sort of ignore the motor wheels. So the heart of it is the five Chi wheels and the five Psi wheels. So this was the machine that Flowers was confronted with when he entered the attack on Tunny. The basic way that the Tunny machine encrypts is it lays down two layers of encryption. The Chi wheels lay down the first layer of encryption, and the Psi wheels lay down the second layer of encryption. And what it does at each of those two stages is it kind of obscures the plain text letter by masking it or adding to it a letter of what they called key. The key was produced by the wheels. And the idea is that key, that's just a stream of random-looking letters, which is used to mask the plain text message. So you've got sort of one layer of masking laid down by the Chi wheels, and then you've got the second layer of masking laid down by the Psi wheels. So just to work the process through, suppose the first letter of the German message is P. The first letter of the plain text is P. So the operator types P at the, this is the teleprinter keyboard. So teleprinters were a bit like modern computer keyboards. As you know, when you press your computer keyboard, circuitry behind the scenes turns the letter that you press, P, say, into a string of zeros and ones, into a string of bits. With a modern computer keyboard, it's typically going to be ASCII that's used, the ASCII system for encoding letters. So you'll get a stream of seven or eight bits that corresponds to your key press of P. With Tunny, they didn't use ASCII. The ASCII convention hadn't been invented at that stage. They used teleprinter code. In teleprinter code, each keyboard character is associated with its own unique packet of five zeros and ones. So P in teleprinter code is represented as 01101. That was how teleprinters worked. There was nothing secret at all about that. Teleprinters were in widespread use at that time all around the world for sending telegrams, telexes, and so on. Teleprinter code was entirely open. And what Tunny did was encrypted teleprinter code. So what is this business about adding letters to other letters? Adding numbers makes perfect sense, but how do you add letters to each other to do this masking process? The addition was done at the bit level. It wasn't really the letters themselves that were added. It was the zeros and ones in the teleprint representations of the letters that got added. And the rules for addition that the German engineers had wired into the Tunny machine were mostly what you'd expect of addition. 0 + 0 = 0. 0 + 1 = 1. 1 + 0 = 1. So everything's exactly what you'd expect so far. The surprise is 1 + 1 = 0. There was a good reason why they did it that way. They weren't just bad mathematicians. But anyway, that was how this adder worked. It just implemented those four very simple rules. So P is going into the adder from the keyboard, and then the Chi wheels deliver the first obscuring character, which is M. And the teleprint code for M is 00111. Why were there five Chi wheels? Well, because there are five bits in the teleprint representation of M, five zeros and ones, and one wheel produced a single bit. So to get five bits, you needed five wheels. So now once the two ingredients, the M and the P, were assembled in the adder could add them up. So we've got 0 + 0, which is 0. And then we've got 0 plus 1, which is 1. And then we've got 1 plus 1. And that's the funny case where 1 plus 1 equals 0. So the third output bit is 0. And then we've got 1 plus 0, which is 1. And then we've got 1 plus 1, which is 0 again. And those five bits just happen to be the teleprint representation of R. So the first stage has now been completed. The first letter of plain text has been masked by having an M added to it, and it's turned into an R. And then the R goes into the second adder, and then the process is basically repeated. The side wheels deliver another letter, which is added to the R. You've got R plus H, V comes out, and then this stream of bits goes to radio and is broadcast to the far end of the link. The reason they chose that funny rule of 1 plus 1 equals 0 was to make addition reversible. If you have 1 plus 1 equals 2, you're not going to get the property of reversibility. By using the funny 1 plus 1 rule, they made it the case that if you add M to P, you get R, and then if you add M again to R, that takes you back to P. That's what that 1 plus 1 equals 0 rule buys you. If you add a letter the first time, you get some result, and then if you add the same letter again a second time, it takes you back to where you started. So that was how the Tunny machine was able to decrypt. The message was encoded by the sender's machine by having these letters added, and then the receiver's machine just added the same letters to the ciphertext, and the plain text would appear at the far end of the link. It was a very clever idea. This was kind of the best encryption system in the world at that time, and it remained so for many decades. Even today, the basic encryption system used in Tunny is still used for some applications. It was cutting-edge crypto technology for decades. All that I've just explained was scoped out by Bill Tutt, one of the greatest codebreakers at Bletchley Park. They'd never seen a Tunny machine here. The situation was different with Enigma. The war started with, you know, people here had Enigma machines on their desks. The British had been given replica Enigma machines by the Poles, and then more Enigma machines were very rapidly captured during the Norwegian campaign. So this place was brimming with Enigma machines. But the codebreakers never saw a Tunny machine until the very last days of the war in 1945. Tutt had to work out how the Tunny machine worked by pure deduction. And he did manage to do that, remarkably. He managed to fathom out all the details that I've just explained to you, that there were 12 wheels and they divided it into three groups, and the motor wheels and the chi wheels and the psi wheels, and the chi wheels did this and the psi wheels did that and so on. He figured all that out without ever having set his eyes on a Tunny machine. It's remarkable. And moreover, he managed to do it on the basis of just two intercepted messages, about 4,000 characters long. It's one of the most remarkable feats of cryptanalysis in the entire war. Perhaps it's one of the most remarkable feats of cryptanalysis ever. I mean, they don't tell us what's happened since the end of the Second World War, so we don't know what great feats have been. We will eventually. Historians will win in the end. But, you know, Tutt's triumph with Tunny may even stand above what's been done in recent years. We don't know, but it might. So Tutt had broken the machine, as they say. He'd worked out the structure of the Tunny machine. But there are two things that you need to do when you're trying to bludgeon your way into a new cipher system. The first is to work out the structure of the machine, and that Tutt had now done. And then the second thing is to devise a method for actually reading the daily messages. Because simply knowing the structure of the machine isn't enough to get you into the message traffic, because these machines are designed so that the enemy can capture them and still not be able to read the encoded messages. So just knowing the structure of the machine could never be enough. And this is where Turing made his contribution. Once Tutt had worked out how the machine itself worked, Turing came up with the first systematic method for breaking into the daily Tunny traffic. In the laconic jargon of this place, it was called simply Turingery. And Turingery was the third of Turing's three greatest contributions to the Second World War. He broke the form of Enigma used by the North Atlantic U-boats. He designed the bomb and he invented Turingery, the first method for use against honey. Turingery was a hand method. It wasn't implemented by machine. There was a section here called the testery where people used Turingery to break tunny messages using paper and pencil, and it was rather like doing crossword puzzles, I suppose, but much more difficult. The core to Turingery was a bit of crypto technology that Turing invented called deltering. It's called differencing also. And differencing is still big news in code breaking today, but Turing invented it in 1942. And the idea of differencing is that it's a kind of sideways addition. So if you've got a stream of characters, A, B, C, D, so maybe that's an extract from the ciphertext that you're trying to break, to difference or delta A, B, C, D, you add the letters together sideways. You add A to B, and the addition is of course, at the bit level, as I've explained. You add the teleprint representations. But you add A to B, and then you add B to C, and then you add C to D. So that's deltering. And you might naturally think that if you've got a ciphertext and then you delta the ciphertext, you're going to end up with something that's even more scrambled than the ciphertext itself. But remarkably, Turing was able to show that this process of deltering would reveal information that was otherwise hidden. And in fact, deltering was used in all the anti-Tunney algorithms that were run on the Colossi. So in that sense, the whole computer-based attack on Tunney hung off this invention of Turing's in 1942, the invention of deltering as part of Turingery. Tunney was much higher level than Enigma. Tunney was really Hitler's BlackBerry. It was used for just the highest level traffic. And thanks to Turingery, Bletchley Park was pretty much able to listen in to what Hitler and his generals were saying to each other over breakfast. Tunney was Hitler's BlackBerry and Turing had hacked into the system. And you could imagine the kinds of information that would be flowing in these Tunney messages. And some of these messages would be really quite long. One of the advantages of Tunney over Enigma was that you could send very long messages, kind of 40, 50-page emails could easily be sent by Tunney. So you were getting all sorts of situation reports and assessments and discussions between the German high command in Berlin and the frontline generals who were actually there doing the fighting. You know, maybe a discussion about what should our tactics be in this battle that we're planning for next Tuesday? Should the panzer divisions do a classic pincer movement or should they try out some other kind of tactics for this battle? And by the way, how many tanks do we think the Russians have got in a certain location? And how many tanks and how many Messerschmitts are we going to have available by next Tuesday? So all this priceless information was being read at Bletchley Park thanks to Turingery. Turingery, though, as I say, was a hand method, and so breaking messages by Turingery was a slow business, but it was the best weapon that the codebreakers had against Tunney for about the first year of the attack on Tunney. And although the going was so slow, they nevertheless managed to break more than 1 million characters of ciphertext in that period. It's quite a staggering total, I think, for a hand-based method. But obviously they needed something faster to keep up with the ever-increasing volume of Tunney messages. And also they needed something that was kind of more mechanical. Turingery depended crucially on human intelligence. It depended on insight. It depended on, as Tutte put it, what you felt in your bones. Tutte was quite sniffy about Turingery. I think there was probably some kind of rivalry between Tutte and Turing. You know, Tutte had made this incredible intellectual contribution of reverse engineering the Tunney machine, and then Turing stepped in and produced the method that actually delivered the bacon. So I think Tutte was probably feeling, you know, a bit put in the shade by Turing. And he described Turingery as more artistic than mathematical. Tutte was, of course, a mathematician, so that was, you know, quite an insult from Tutte's lips. Tutte dreamed of a method for breaking Tunney messages that was so mechanical, so cut and dried, that even a machine could carry it out. And later that year, towards the end of 1942, Tutte was able to invent a method by using a very ingenious extension of deltering. This was Tut's second great contribution to the attack on Tunny. First he'd broken the machine, and now he invents this entirely mechanical method for breaking Tunny messages. But there was just one snag with Tut's brilliant new method, and that was that it involved a huge amount of low-grade calculation, so much calculation that it would in fact have taken years to break a single message using the hand-breaking methods that were currently in play against Tunny. So Tut didn't quite know what to do about this. And then one day, Tut explained his new method to Max Newman. Newman was Turing's teacher at Cambridge. He was a number of years Turing's senior, and he gave a course of lectures on the foundations of mathematics in 1935 that Turing attended. And by Newman's own account, it was in these lectures that some way of presenting a problem that Newman used set Turing off on the quest that led eventually to the invention of the universal Turing machine. Newman said, oh, we could surely build a machine of some sort to solve these mathematical problems. And that set Turing off thinking, well, what kind of machine and how exactly should it work? And that's how the universal Turing machine was invented in 1936. Newman stayed on in Cambridge, giving his lectures, doing his mathematical research until 1942, and then eventually he too was lured to Bletchley Park, and he joined the attack on Tunny. So one day Tut was explaining his new method to Newman, and Newman immediately said, let's use electronics to do the calculations and speed everything up and make it practicable to break messages in a realistic amount of time. Newman knew that high-speed digital counters had been constructed and used effectively before the war in Cambridge to count radioactive emissions in the Cavendish Laboratory in Cambridge. And in a moment of brilliance, Newman saw that that technology could be transferred to the completely different technology of breaking Tunny messages and do the low-grade calculation that was required to implement Tut's new method. Newman was put in charge of the project of building a suitable machine, and when it came along in the middle of 1943, it was called Heath Robinson, after the, in those days, famous cartoonist who drew kind of overly ingenious contrivances, contrivances that were so brilliant that they could never actually work. The first time Heath Robinson was switched on, smoke started coming out of the electrical equipment. A large resistor overloaded, and the engineers had to go in and change it before they could get the machine working. You can see these two gigantic metal frames here. They called these the bedsteads. Each bedstead carried a punched paper tape. One of those paper tapes contained the Tunny message that they were trying to break, and the other paper tape contained the entire output from the Chi wheels as they rotated through all their possible positions. So this long stream of letters that the Chi wheels would produce as they rotated through all their possible positions. That was on the second tape. And then what the Heath Robinson did following Tut's method was kind of compared the characters on those two tapes at relatively high speed. Heath Robinson worked. It was kind of a cranky machine, but it did show that it was possible to do deltering at relatively high speeds in a machine. It showed that it was practicable to implement Tut's method. I think it's true to say that Heath Robinson never worked particularly well. There was great trouble with the tapes, and the tapes would suddenly break as they were spinning at high speed, and they'd disintegrate as they ran through the machine. And everything, the people in the room and the other bits of equipment and so on, would be festooned with little tendrils of shredded paper tape. And the machine would overheat, and it didn't go too well. Heath Robinson was basically a relay-based machine. Newman's idea was to use some electronics for the counters, and that they did. But there were only about 2 to 3 dozen electronic valves in Heath Robinson, and all the rest was relays. When they were manufacturing Heath Robinson, before the first one was installed, they were having great trouble with the relay-based logic unit for the machine. So they needed a relay expert to help them debug the logic unit and get it working properly. And so Turing suggested Flowers. So Flowers was sent along to have a look at the designs of Heath Robinson and what they'd managed to build so far. He did manage to get the logic unit working for them, but as soon as he saw Heath Robinson, he hated it. He knew they were going in completely the wrong direction. There weren't enough valves in Heath Robinson. He could see that. He knew that all these relays would slow everything down. Heath Robinson could never give the code breakers the speed and reliability that they needed to break the tunny traffic. And moreover, Flowers could see that they were never really going to solve the problem of keeping the two tapes in synchrony. Because as these two tapes span at high speed on these wheels, the tapes would stretch and wear, and eventually they'd drift out of synchronization. And then you'd be comparing the wrong row of holes with the wrong row of holes, and because the tapes had moved relative to each other. And so you'd never get the right answer out of the machine. So Flowers said, look, forget these devices. Let me build you an all-electronic machine for attacking tunny. He proposed a machine containing 2,000 valves. He knew that the valves would give the speed that was necessary, the reliability that was necessary, and also he knew that he could solve the two-tape problem by, in effect, using electronics to create the data that was on one of the tapes internally inside the machine. So his machine, Colossus, would only need a single tape, the tape with the message on it, and this other tape with the Chi stream on, that the Robinson needed. That was unnecessary because Flowers' electronics would be generating the Chi stream internally. Sounded an absolute winner of an idea. Bletchley Park took advice from other experts who said, this guy Flowers is crazy. Don't touch it with a barge pole. This will never work. He wants to use 2,000 valves in a single installation. You just can't do that kind of thing. Valves will always be dying. The machine's going to be out of action for a much greater proportion of time than it's actually working. It's a bad idea. Don't touch it. Send him home. So that essentially is what Bletchley Park did. They just didn't want to know about Flowers' idea for an all-electronic computer. Newman was kind of encouraging. He understood that Flowers was a brilliant engineer, and he kind of said, well, look, if you think you can build it, you go ahead and try. But Flowers got no official backing from Bletchley Park, no resources, no support. Flowers just quietly went back to his own laboratory in Dollis Hill and got on with building the all-electronic machine that he knew the codebreakers needed. He said that he and his team worked for 10 months to build the first Colossus during 1943. He said they worked until their eyes dropped out. They worked night and day. And then one day in early January 1944, some of Flowers' lads turned up with Colossus here on the back of a lorry. This is probably the most significant moment in the history of modern computing, kind of radically understated. These guys just turning up with the first large-scale electronic computer on the back of a lorry. It took them a few days to install Colossus here and get it working. And the code breakers were immediately impressed by the speed of Colossus. They were just blown away by the speed of this machine. And they were also apparently fascinated by the fact that if you set Colossus the same problem twice, it would produce the same answer both times. So we can infer that Heath Robinson did not always do that. A new era has started. The electronic computer has arrived. The world will never be the same again.
Thanks to the paid and volunteer staff, veterans and visitors who took part in this podcast. For more information about Bletchley Park, go to bletchleypark.org.uk. Remember, you can follow us on Twitter, where we're at @bparkpodcast, or join the Bletchley Park podcast Facebook group. You can follow our channel on Audioboo, or subscribe to the podcast via the RSS feed or iTunes. And don't be shy. If you enjoy the podcast, then please just take a couple of minutes and rate it and maybe even leave a review on iTunes. Thanks to Audioboo, who make this podcast possible. This podcast is produced for the Bletchley Park Trust by MC Fontaine.
Thanks for listening, and we'll have more decrypts from the home of the codebreakers next month.